You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Across the state of Wisconsin, Daybreak with Brian and Jamie is back.
It's 8:06 right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Happy Friday. We love being able to say that because even in the midst of a lot of not great news over the course of the last few days, we can always celebrate the fact that we are all ready for a weekend. My name is Jamie Martinson.
Good morning. I'm Brian Noonan. Are you being affected by, is your insurance being affected? Are you about to lose Medicaid coverage? Let us know why and let us know what you're going to do to try to fix that situation that you're in. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I ask you that because Wisconsin could see tens of thousands of residents lose Medicaid coverage because of new federal policy changes take effect under the one big beautiful bill. Some analyses estimate about 276,000 Wisconsinites could lose health coverage by 2034 when Medicaid cuts are combined with Affordable Care Act changes and new eligibility rules. And that's Rand Health has done a new analysis, and they estimate that state Medicaid budgets will be reduced by about $665 billion, that's nationwide, over the next decade due to funding cuts in President Trump's big, beautiful bill. Well, there's more good news in case of war. You were thinking, you know, a war is pretty bad, but it could be worse. Oh, we got a new mixed martial artist heading Department of Homeland Security. It could be worse. How about we throw in you might not have health insurance anymore? Does that rise to the level of please stop?
I mean, really, at this point, we're looking at one in five residents relying on Medicaid for their health care coverage, meaning policy changes are going to affect a large portion of this population here in Wisconsin and across the country. And when you think about it, I know this administration likes to pile on the fact that some of these programs like SNAP, Medicaid, are only for poor people. They want the rolls from each of the states so that they can see how many illegal immigrants are taking these services. And that's not actually true because these coverages, like Medicaid, affect low-income families. They're affecting children. They're affecting seniors in long-term care. They're affecting people with disabilities. You're talking about small business owners. You're talking about farming families. You're talking about families who have two parents who are working but still can't afford the health care. So you're not just talking about the poorest of the poor or immigrants. You are talking about all swaths of people in all walks of life who just need a little help in order to have health insurance. And I know you like to tell me that I'm Pollyanna with my rose-colored glasses, but I believe that health care, good health care or basic health care, is a fundamental right for people in this country.
I do as well, and it infuriates me that it's not. But as we talked about earlier in the show, when the president said he didn't care and wasn't concerned about the rising gas prices, this administration does not concern itself with that right. type of issue. That's an empathetic human issue. It's part of the culture war. It's easy to spin and make it a talking point. Like you say, we target these are the people that are using this. And it's not true, but it doesn't matter. You repeat a lie enough till it becomes the truth. And they don't care. They don't have to worry about it. So if they don't have to worry about it, they don't worry about it for anybody else. It's every person for themselves in this current climate, and that includes healthcare, which is a worldwide shame on this country.
Yes.
We are so developed and we have so much going on in this country, and yet we can't meet people's simplest needs, or at least give them help to meet it on their own.
Right.
You know, we're doing away with all of that.
And that's the unfortunate part. And when you look at this Rand report, it's it's actually a little scary as we look ahead to what's to come in the next few years based on what they're finding. Because most of us know that Medicaid is the is a public health insurance program, right? Which means it's funded by the federal and state governments. And when federal funding drops, like it's going to because of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, that means that the states either have to cover more of the costs themselves, they have to cut services, or they have to reduce enrollment completely. And you look at some of these states where you have a great number of people using Medicare or Medicaid and Medicare. And I look at states that, and I don't want to pick on them, but we're looking at states that primarily vote for this particular president. We're talking about
facts
the red
facts,
voting
Jamie.
States.
Yes, so we're talking. Right.
And when you talk about that, you are talking about people who are going to be affected in the most basic possible way. We're talking about not being able to get medicine. We're talking about not being able to go to the doctor for some of those illnesses that obviously need some sort of check, right? And so that's a fundamental right that we should be given. And this RAND report estimates that the federal government, this is what's mind-boggling, will save about $714 billion between 2025 and 2034 from the changes that were implemented because of the Big Beautiful Bill Act. Where's that money going?
Well, I think we know the answer in the short term to that. And when you look at, that's an unbelievably high number.
It is.
But when you look at what we're spending right now every day for this war that Donald Trump got us into, it's nothing. It's like a day.
Yeah.
So, see, this is where, and I don't, listen, I don't try to pick on people who voted for
right.
this administration. But when there was all this talk about Obamacare, which is another way they spun it to make it easy to blame, people didn't understand that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare were the same thing. And you're right. And that was across the country. But in these predominantly red areas where people had supported this administration, they voted against their own self-interest, and then they were surprised. And I'm not making a judgment on the people.
Right.
You can do that yourself, or they can do that themselves, of why they were lured into believing something that was going to hurt them. But at least on the Democratic side, I do believe that most of us think that healthcare doesn't see politics. Healthcare doesn't care who you voted for.
Mm-hmm.
When people are sick, if you're really sick, you'll go to a doctor. You don't care who they voted for. If you need medicine, you don't care who, if the pharmacy tech was of a different party or if the manufacturer was of a different party. You want that health care. And you also don't want to worry that when you get sick, not only that you're going to get better, but that you're going to be bankrupted.
Right.
That should be the last thing you have to worry about. That getting sick is going to ruin your entire life and your family's life.
Right. When you look at this RAND health analysis, you mentioned it. By 2034, about 7.6 million fewer people are expected to be enrolled in Medicaid nationwide because of some of the new rules and these funding changes that are going to take place. One major factor that is being analyzed right now is some of these new federal work requirements for some Medicaid recipients, which are expected to reduce the number of people eligible for the program. This law also limits the use of provider taxes. And if you're not familiar with that, that's a financing strategy that a lot of states use to draw down additional federal Medicaid funding. That limits the option, though, and will force some states to dip into their general budgets to make up the difference. Now, some states don't have 2.4 billion dollars sitting in a surplus, right, like the state of Wisconsin currently has, and million, by the way. I said billion with a B, but it is million. I'll correct myself on the air. And we're going to see some states who are going to be impacted differently. So, for example, Brian, Arizona, Iowa, and Nevada could see Medicaid budgets fall by more than 15%. California, New York will see the largest total dollar losses, about $112 billion and $63 billion respectively. That's notice, weird. Yeah, right? There's a little commonality there.
Your home state, your former home state,
yes,
is on the other side of the spectrum, which is odd. So let's tell me that, and then we'll see. Then we'll compare. Let's do a side by side.
Yes. So Tennessee, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Kentucky, they could see actually see more than a 2% in general fund savings, largely because fewer people will be enrolled in Medicaid. And then states like you mentioned it, South Dakota and Wyoming, could even see slight budget increases due to additional rural health funding, which is going to be included in this law. Now, here's the thing that I keep thinking about. Two things, right?
Yes.
Hospitals and clinics all across the state of Wisconsin already rely heavily on Medicaid reimbursements. And by the way, in the state of Wisconsin, we call it Badger Care. So don't be confused. If you're on Badger Care, we're talking about you. Yeah. Rural hospitals in particular depend on that funding to keep their doors open. And health policy experts say that when Medicaid funding drops, those rural systems often are the first to feel the pressure. We already have a deficit in healthcare in our rural areas. So what is going to happen in the state of Wisconsin when we see this kind of decrease in Medicaid funding? And now all of a sudden we're losing even more healthcare systems across the state. The other thing I want to point out is if you have private health insurance and you think you're going to be safe from any sort of premium hikes because, oh, I don't have Badger Care. I don't need the state to help me. I don't need the government to help me. Who do you think is going to pay for the people going in who have absolutely no health insurance? It's going to be the people with private health insurance because those prices have to then increase to help the offset for the medical health, for the medical system.
And if you don't think that that's going to be a talking point for certain people, look at all these freeloaders now that are having to go and you go in uninsured and you're paying for it and you need, it's just another way to target a them. We always need to have an enemy, a them. And so suddenly it'll be the people whose Medicaid was cut and now they don't have insurance. Well, illness doesn't care if you have insurance or not. If you're going to get sick, you're going to get sick. And, you know, but it'll be easy then to blame them. It's hard to see. And especially you mentioned Wisconsin, and we've talked a lot about rural hospitals and rural, you know, first of all, just the lack of doctors in these rural areas. And then it gets down now the lack of any medical professionals in some of these rural areas and clinics and hospitals having to close. And even if some hospitals stay open, their services now are much more limited. So you're still, you might be able to go to an emergency room, but you better hope it's not really serious because your local place isn't going to be able to do it. And then you're going to have to be either transported by yourself or be transported. And then just watch the costs go up.
I mean, there are people who drive over an hour just to see a doctor. And then there are people that, because, as you're mentioning, these hospitals are understaffed, you wait hours to see somebody when you're sick or you have some sort of emergency. And they have to prioritize people coming in their doors of who's most serious to who's least serious. Well, how do you know that? You don't know what they have because you don't actually have the people to see them. Healthcare is not a luxury. This isn't some sort of luxury good. It's not some sort of luxury product. And I'm so tired of having the discussions about basic needs like healthcare and food as some sort of bureaucratic hoop that you have to jump through. I mean, these are things that you should not be expected to jump through. They're basic necessities in life. And this is something—
Jamie, if you deserve to eat and be healthy, you should have pulled yourself up by your bootstraps like me.
I guess.
Have your dad give you $1 million loan, and that's how we do it. That's how we become successful, not losers and suckers. That's it.
We need these things to live and work and raise our families, but, you know, I digress. Whatever. It's 8:19 right now. You are listening to Daybreak. I am Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Question for after. In your opinion, why do you think Trump treats the deaths of military members in such a cavalier manner? We'll get to your thoughts on that right here on the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Want to join in on the conversation? Call or text 855-75-CIVIC. Now back to Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:22 right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I am Jamie Martinson.
Oh, and I'm Brian Noonan. Hey, how are you? It's Friday. I was listening to a little Creedence, a little Fortunate Son. I'm here. I'm just in the groove, man, because
it's a great song. It's Friday.
And we have to talk about something that is that I wish we didn't have to talk about. We've never had to talk about it before. The way a president tonally discusses the deaths of U.S. service members. We know, unfortunately, to this point, that six American service members have already been killed in the war with Iran. From the start, the president has acknowledged that American casualties were a possibility, and he's done it in a way that has not really ingratiated himself to the American public. And I can only imagine the military, and that's why I want to know, whether you're in the military or not, in your opinion, why do you think that the president treats the deaths of military members in such a cavalier manner? 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. So when he spoke about the dead and wounded service members, he does it very bad. It's not, I'm sure he has skills. I haven't seen him, but this is definitely not one of them. And it is a real blind spot. And now we're seeing it up close. And there was a this came about because we both saw this very interesting analysis on CNN yesterday. And we're thinking about it. And it just, did you ever think, Jamie, you'd live in a country where we had to worry that our president was not being respectful enough and treating the death of our service members as just the cost of doing business?
No, but let's be honest. Since he came into public light, this president has not been kind to service members, right? Past, living, dead. I mean, he has... It's worth remembering, all right? Very, very quickly, back in 2015, he mocked Senator John McCain for being a prisoner of war, saying he preferred people who were captured. There were reports from his own former staff that he referred to fallen American soldiers as losers and suckers. Obviously, that sparked outrage among veteran groups. He's publicly attacked decorated military leaders who disagreed with him, including generals who spent decades serving this country. And he's also questioned the service of Gold Star families who lost loved ones in combat. So this is not new. What we're hearing this week
is not new. It's still, though.
It's gross,
It's still gross. Yeah, gross is a good term for it. It's gross. And now it's not only him, but it's Pete. But just in case you're thinking, hey, Brian and Jamie, why are you always trying to make the president look bad? Maybe we should just let him talk and so we can judge for ourselves. Okay, that's fine. How about cut eight, Parker?
And sadly, there will likely be more. Before it ends, that's the way it is. Likely be more, but we'll do everything possible where that won't be the case.
Obviously referring to the deaths of the service members already in this war in the Middle East. So
that's
far,
the way it is, Jamie.
Six.
They're there.
Six so far. Many, many wounded. Seriously wounded as well. But it's they're noble. He's called them noble. He's told them they're giving up a sacrifice for their country.
But also, they equate it with a holy war, that they're basically doing the Lord's work. Now, Alicia, who's jumping in on socials, we know is a veteran. And she says he views our service members as tools, not people. Yeah, there's no humanity when he talks about them. He says what he thinks people want to hear.
Right.
But you can tell by the way he says it. And I have this argument with my daughter all the time. It's not what you say sometimes, it's how you say it. Mm-hmm. And to say, listen, everybody knows that in a military conflict or in a war, there is a chance that service members will die. But to say that's just the way it is flippant and disrespectful. And it just, it's I am out of touch. I am the king. And I'm sending these people into battle for me. And they will, yes, some of you will not come back. And I'm sure, you know, every military member in the back of their mind has that inkling, but they do the job anyway, and
right.
they deserve to be covered
right.
when, you know, their names deserve to be read. And that's what Pete Hegseth yesterday said
yes.
he doesn't want to happen.
Right. And this was during a press briefing at the Pentagon. And the defense secretary actually criticized the media for supposedly focusing too much on the dead soldiers in an effort to make the president, quote unquote, look bad. And he actually suggested that those deaths were getting disproportionate play compared to the military successes. This is cut 9.
This is what the fake news misses. We've taken control of Iran's airspace and waterways without boots on the ground. We control their fate. But when a few drones get through or tragic things happen, it's front page news. I get it. The press only wants to make the president look bad, but try for once to report the reality. The terms of this war will be set by us at every step.
Nobody. How narcissistic do you have to be? To believe that because we are reporting the names of American service members who have been killed in a war that the majority of this country does not want to be in because you haven't told us why we're actually there, how dare you think that this is about you? What are you talking about? The press has always covered the deaths of
yes.
American service people.
That's their job.
Always.
That's journalism. It's the job. And sometimes the job is hard. And you can say what you want about the press, but sometimes they have to report hard facts.
And if it makes you look bad, that's the
right.
what you signed up for, brother.
This isn't a political hit job. When the press reports on casualties, when they're reporting on the consequences of military action or the risks of escalating a conflict, they're doing what they're supposed to do by telling the public what is actually happening. It's 8:29 right now. You are listening to Daybreak. I am Jamie Martinson.
And after the break, we're going to talk about pie. And no, that's not a euphemism. We're on the Civic Media Network.
Local voices, statewide impact. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:35 right now. Very good choice of music, Parker, because that is perfect going into this next segment. Because, Brian, we are going to drop the political talk because, thank God, we need to. It's a Friday.
It's Friday.
And we're going to talk about something we can all agree on. I don't care how you vote. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. We can all agree that pie, Brian, is absolutely delicious. And we're excited.
There's no doubt about it. Pie bridges all gaps.
It does.
And we got it. Pie Day is coming up, mm-hmm. you know, the 14th. But we're not talking math. We're talking real pie.
Right.
And the only person qualified to come here and talk real pie with us is Beth Howard. She is the pie lady. She is the author of 4 books. Her new award-winning documentary, Piowa, A Piece of America, is out now. BethHoward.com is her website. Beth, thanks for being here. So many questions about pie. Let's start with the foundation. Every good pie comes down to being judged by the crust. Now you've got the regular crust, mm-hmm. graham cracker crust, but for a regular flaky pie crust that you'd see in your apple pie, your cherry pie, that kind of thing. What is the secret? Because people get lazy, they buy the pre-rolled stuff. But what's the secret for a really good pie crust?
I would say butter. Butter is the secret. It's the flavor. And also butter mixed with lard or mixed with Crisco, like a vegetable shortening.
Oh.
Because then you get the taste, you know, the butter flavor and then the lightness of the other half of whatever you choose to use, the other fat. And a light touch, like it's not bread. So, you know, you don't need it. It's just very, very quick. You can make it with your hands and you just kind of fluff the water in with the dough and you're not like pushing on it. So I would say that's it. In my film, there's an award-winning pie maker who she's won all these ribbons at the state fair. She says you have to be frustrated with your dough when you're rolling it out. If you're not frustrated, you've put too much water in it. So like there's this, you know, this supposed rule about don't put too much water in your pie crust. And I always tell people, like, don't worry about that. That's not the worst thing you could do. And also, I don't want to be frustrated when I'm rolling my pie dough.
Say, yeah, that sounds like too much work. If you get frustrated.
I mean, she is, I have to say, she is right that you will get a lighter, flakier crust, but I'm like, I would just rather take the stress out of it. And, you know, it doesn't make my crust hard. It just doesn't fall apart, you know, but it's all good. It doesn't matter. And also when you make a homemade pie and share it with somebody, nobody cares.
Exactly.
Right.
No one is judging how, you put too much water in your dough. No one is going to judge you.
Unless you have that woman over, and then she's constantly
then she's
judging.
Gonna judge
but that's
you.
Why I don't invite her over.
So when it comes to making the perfect pie crust, right, or the pie crust that we feel like is perfect for ourselves, do we need any sort of special tools for that? I mean, can we use basic things that we have in our kitchen? What would you recommend for the pie novices out there? Because I'll be honest, I'm usually a pre-made pie crust person because I don't trust my own skills. So I want to get better at this. So I want you to teach me.
Okay, so first of all, in my film, Jan Miller, the food editor from Better Homes and Gardens, says it's okay to use a cheater crust.
Okay.
She puts it in air. So just first of all, you know, take the pressure off yourself. No one's going to judge you. But what would be my, what was your question?
The tool. The tools. It's good. So what should we be using?
The tools. So, you know, I travel a lot and I make pie in random kitchens and they don't always have the tools. So I always say, you know, first of all, your best tools are your own two hands. You make the dough and you don't even need a bowl, actually. You can make a pile of flour on the table and mix it all in. It's interesting how little you really actually need. You know, a rolling pin. If you don't have a rolling pin, I've used a wine bottle or any kind of, you know, big glass bottle. And there is one tool, though, that I really like. And I get it from the dollar store and it costed like $1.25 for this. It's called a bench scraper in the technical food terms, but it's a little rectangle piece of metal that helps you lift the dough off of the counter.
Okay.
And that is, for me, essential. That's my favorite tool. Everything else I could do without, you know, with the tools, but that little scraper is super helpful. And then you nudge a little flour underneath as you're trying to lift it, because the butter will kind of melt onto the rolling surface and get sticky. So you want to help lift that off without ripping your dough, because that's one of the things that makes people upset when I can't make my own dough because it sticks. But that's a way to help keep it, to get it off the counter.
Okay.
Use the extra flour to help keep it from sticking.
Beth Howard is our guest. She is the pie lady. You could go to theworldneedsmorepie.com because if you go there, you'll learn all of these tricks, you'll learn recipes, and you'll learn all about Piowa, Piece of America, the new award-winning documentary that is out. And I love the poster for it, American Gothic, but they're eating some cherry pie, which is great. I, Beth, enjoy the graham cracker crust, whether it's on a keem lime pie, a pecan pie, any of those. What's the biggest mistake people make? Because sometimes you get a graham cracker crust and it is phenomenal. And other times, boy, they fall short. What's the biggest mistake we make when we're trying to do that?
Well, what's your definition of falling short? What do you mean it falls
where
apart?
It's very crumbly and it also tastes almost like, I guess, be overcooked might be the problem, because it gets that burnt sugar kind of taste to it.
Well, the way I make it, and my partner, he makes key lime pie all the time, so he's become like an expert at the graham cracker crust, and he's been experimenting. He puts extra butter in it, and he uses brown sugar in the crust instead of a little white sugar. And I sometimes don't put any sugar in it just because graham crackers are already sweet. But the brown sugar almost kind of helps hold the cracker crumbs together a little bit better. And then, you know, you press it down into the dish firmly. But I think it's between the butter and the brown sugar, those would be my
butter seems to be the key. Cardiologists must love
you. Oh, yeah. Butter. And, I mean, who doesn't love butter, the combo of butter and brown sugar?
Heathens.
Just makes me want a graham cracker crust right now.
There are certain recipes that ask you to do a pre-bake of those graham cracker crusts when you make them at home. Is that something you recommend, or should we just...
Yeah, I do. I think 10, 20 minutes, something like that. It's, it's not too long. It's just enough to kind of firm it all up, the butter and the sugar, and hold it all together. All right. Yeah, it's good.
Our senior producer, Frank, has actually gone to the text line. He's foregone talking to us directly. He's gone to the text line. He says he messes up his dough, his pie crust, all the time. And you mentioned before, sometimes it's better to do butter with a little bit of lard or shortening in there. Is there a ratio? Is it better to mix that in rather than go straight butter?
I find it makes a lighter, flakier crust to mix them. Sometimes when I make an all butter crust, it just comes out tough. And I don't know. I really just don't know why. And, and the other thing is, like, every ingredient, every brand is different, right? Different brands of butter have different moisture contents, different shortenings have different consistencies. So it can't be an exact science. You have to, like, work with what you have. I don't know. So I would want to know what his issue is with his crust. Is it falling apart when he's trying to roll it? Is it too hard? If it's too hard to work with, then you overworked the dough and it's, you released all this gluten and then it's just too tough to work. And sometimes you do actually have to start over. If you've overworked it, there's no going back.
Okay.
So keeping a very light touch when you're mixing it and then adding enough water so it holds together while you're rolling it without it just being a crumbling mess. And that's pretty much it. And, use enough flour when you sprinkle your rolling surface on the top of the dough and underneath so that it doesn't stick. The ratios, though, it's a 2.5 for a standard two crust pie. It's 2.5 cups of all purpose flour, right. Half a cup butter and half a cup of whatever fat or, shortening or lard. So
is there a brand you prefer? Because you said every butter is different, every shortening is different. Is there a brand that you like?
No, I'm always on the move. There's every place I go has different brands, and I'm not fussy.
Okay.
And I just keep coming back to this thing, like as we complicate our world and complicate our recipes, and then we have to make everything Instagram worthy. And it's just like, the pioneers made pie, okay?
Yeah.
The
right.
pioneers, and they did not have all the fancy shops and the fancy brands, and they weren't importing their fruit all wrapped individually in paper. And you're just like, stop, people. Just let's go back to the basics. And that's what drew me to pie is I had this big .com job and I was creating virtual worlds. And I'm like, I just want to go work with my hands.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of pie making. It engages your senses and it takes you out of this high-tech, isolated world we live in, and it brings you back into the kitchen where you're using your hands and you're making something that's so satisfying, and then you share it with others, and they are so excited that it's this win-win cycle. It's just not that hard to go in the kitchen, make a pie. It takes time. I think that's the thing that I think recipients of your pie appreciate the most. They realize that you took the time to make something for them, or for your group or wherever you're sharing it, and that's the part that is so meaningful. And I have a 97-year-old woman in my film who says that exact thing. It's the time you put into it. So
yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We're talking with Beth Howard. She is a pie expert. She's an author. She's a blogger. She has a new documentary film. She is essentially the pie lady. The world needs more pie.com. Now, we got to talk about what's inside the crust. We spent a lot of time talking about the crust, but what makes, if we're talking about a fruit pie, right? I'm going to be doing a little taste testing of the cherry pie since cherries are such a big part of Wisconsin's farming industry. All around our listening area. So what should we be looking for, and what fruits are the best inside our pies if we're making those at home, Beth?
I would say the best fruit is what's in your backyard.
Love it.
That's my tag. Whatever's fresh and local, that's when I get really excited about putting in my pie. I love riding my bike over to my neighbor's monster rhubarb patch, and I fill my bike basket with her rhubarb. And go pick your own cherries. How cool is that, right?
Yeah.
And you really kind of have more of a connection to your food. So, the fresher, the better, in my opinion. It should be ripe, obviously, but I definitely have a big preference for the homegrown stuff.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm not an expert on cherries. That's not personally my favorite pie. But you guys also have great apples in Wisconsin.
We do.
Yeah, 100%. Don't discount that.
So you're from Iowa. You started your pie journey in Iowa. What makes Iowa a good subject? And we only have a couple minutes for the new documentary, Piowa.
Well, Iowa just seems to be known for pie. My film kicks off with the fact that I got this pie baking job in Malibu and I had no qualifications. And I said, I'm from Iowa and I got the job. So
nice.
You know, that was like the launching point into this film going, what? Why is that? Like, what is it about Iowa that people automatically think that you make pie because you're from Iowa? And, you know, basically the answer that I heard numerous times in my interviews with people is like, well, it's because it's a farming state. And, you know, traditionally the farm wives and the church ladies, you know, they would always be making pies for their farmers in the field and for their, you know, Sunday lunch on the porch. People stop by and have a slice of pie. You know, it's just this kind of part, it's part of the culture. It just is. And probably because of that being an agricultural state like Wisconsin, where you have a lot of produce around and you have a lot of things you can put in a pie. And anyway, you can put absolutely anything in a pie. So
there's some great, there's some good.
Yeah,
combos
now I want to go
there.
Get a pie right after, right after we're done talking.
Well, if you see my movie, that's the one thing I, people are like, your movie made me so hungry for pie. Like, you're like desperately hungry for pie. And I'm like, that's good. Go make one.
Then you have done your job.
Share it with somebody else.
Yes. And if you want to learn more about the film and everything else from Beth, please go to theworldneedsmorepie.com. And especially in this day and age, that website domain name could not be more true. Beth Howard, the Pie Lady, thank you for joining us this morning. It was a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
This is Daybreak on the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Day 52 right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You are listening to Daybreak on the Civic Media Network. Oh, that's fun. That's that, like, that's the perfect quintessential Dairyland Diaries intro for the state of Wisconsin. And
that is.
I'm very excited. This is second week doing this, but it's one of my favorite segments already.
Well, good. I'm glad you like it. It is it's meant to be uplifting stories from around the state, and that's what we go for. And because today I am nothing if not a champion of women, because we are in International Women's History Month, all of the Dairyland Diary stories center around the ladies. So let's get started. Right down the street at UW-Madison, they have a dance major. Now, you may not think of UW-Madison as a dance school, and you would have been in the same company as President Edward Burge. He did not want the university to be known as a dance school, but it seemed to be going that direction after PE teacher Margaret Hudubler began teaching dance in 1918. At that time, the idea of studying dance was almost unheard of. But in 1926, UW-Madison became host to the nation's first dance major. I know that's what Parker minored in. When Hudubler began teaching at UW-Madison in 1910, she taught phys ed. She taught women's sports, and women's phys ed was undergoing a big change. Physicians, Jamie, this will make you happy. Physicians were finally recognizing the benefits of exercise for women, refuting the popular belief that strenuous physical activity was bad for a woman's health and could lead to infertility because we know you are prone to the vapors. So we didn't want anything happening to you. Whew, I feel a vapor coming on. Well, she, H. Hudubler, was initially charged with teaching women's sports, and then she started teaching dance. And while UW-Madison is today a research institution, unlike at a conservatory for the arts, the students in the dance program are often studying other subjects. But now the dance classes became so popular in Hudubler's days, and I'm probably saying that name wrong, and I apologize. They were attracting 300 to 500 students each year. Now there's so many, and starting this fall, the program will be launching 2 Masters in Fine Arts degree programs for dance. One of them is in screen dance, a hybrid art form between dance and film, where the dance is choreographed specifically for the camera. So who knew that UW-Madison...
That's incredible.
First in the nation for a dance major. Don't you wish you had a leotard on right now, Parker, and could plie for us?
Oh, I could plie.
Oh, shalom.
Even in jeans, he could plie. I love it. we're going to move a little further north in these Dairyland Diaries, because this is also a great story. Denise Flaherty, who is 72, she's a retired corporate worker who now lives on a farm in Baldwin, Wisconsin. She doesn't speak any Spanish. She has no background in social work or immigration law. She has actually stepped into a really major role, though, in her community, because she's helping immigrant families as federal immigration enforcement has increased. Now, Flaherty says that she can drive through Baldwin and point out homes that are now empty because residents have either been detained by federal immigration agents, they've moved out because of out of fear, or they've returned to their home countries. In response to these actions, she now spends most of her days helping the families who remain, many of whom are afraid to leave their homes or even drive anywhere. These are stories we're hearing across the country, but she helps with everyday needs. She goes out and buys them groceries, deposits money at the bank. She takes the kiddos to school. She drives people to court hearings, and she does this through group chats and messaging apps. She also coordinates volunteers who want to help with some of these tasks, like rides to doctors or dentist appointments, or even distributing some of this food. Now, Denise says that she doesn't track immigration agents and focuses only on helping the families, but she still believes that federal agents know who she is. In fact, she says the agents have been to her home before, and after witnessing a recent detention outside of a Mexican grocery store in the city of Baldwin, she says an agent actually called out her name and tried to question her. She left without speaking to him. And since then, she says that she has had to change the car that she drives, but she still continues helping those immigrant families in her community every single day.
Bravo, bravo,
That's
Denise.
Like local heroism on an everyday level.
Quickly, we go to Door County, where Genevieve Hayward has advanced to the top 30 on American Idol. Yes, she's off to Hawaii. She's an indie rock artist. She grew up in Lake Geneva. She has deep ties to Door County. She made it through Hollywood Week. Now she's going on. In Hollywood Week, she performed Brandi Carlile's The Story. And now she is moving on to the top 30 to Hawaii. That round will air Monday, this Monday, March 9th. So if you want to support a local girl on American Idol, there you go. Jamie, I think you can squeeze in this last one.
I think I can get in some of this. Yes. So three Washington middle school counselors, Sandra Gavin, Jessica McAuliffe, and Charles Gill, received the program a promise award from the Wisconsin School Counselor Association for their work, including help with the high school credit course. Students at this Green Bay middle school who were taking high school credit courses weren't passing, and so these counselors wanted to find a way to help them be successful. The counselors focused on that high school credit class because students chose to take it and push themselves, and those students have showed self-motivation, and those counselors wanted to meet them at that advanced level, which is super, super cool. McCullough says winning this award reassures her that she's doing meaningful work that supports students academically and emotionally. She also goes on to say in an email response that it's a great feeling to be recognized for hard work and dedication.
There you go.
That is some good
stuff.
And
I had to leave Charles Gill's name in there, even though he's not a lady.
Well, he wanted to.
He was part of it. He was a third of that. So there you go. A women-focused edition
Love
of Dairyland
that.
Diaries. Hopefully those are stories that leave you with a little buoyancy in your heart, a little spring in your step, and at least not the oppression of the other news that we've heard. We wrap up the week with those. Every week, we've done it two times. So
go and go enjoy these stories with a little buoyancy in your heart while you enjoy some pie. Because
there
that's
you
how you do this.
Good luck on your pie eating contest
Thank you.
This
I'm
weekend,
excited.
Jamie.
I can't
wait to hear about it. And that'll be a video coming out near Pie Day, so be able to check that out.
Everybody will be able to find out my pie ventures, so to speak.
Pie ventures.
Pie ventures.
Another great week. We're glad you were part of it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of the program. Jamie, I'm done.
Yeah, it's 8:59. This is Daybreak on the Civic Media Network. Have a wonderful weekend.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.